Welcome to the Cybersecurity Defenders Podcast, episode number 205. My name is Christopher Luft. I'm one of the co-founders of Lima Charlie, and I will be your host. On today's episode, we're going to be chatting with the one and only Matt Bromley about some cutting-edge intel coming out of the Lima Charlie Community Forum. Another week brings another wave of threat actors, malicious payloads, and compromised systems. In today's episode, we'll be diving into some of the latest intelligence being shared by our incredible Lima Charlie community. A huge shout out to everyone who contributes. It's because of your insights that we can keep these discussions going. And I brought this up for the last couple weeks, but we'll keep saying it for a few weeks more. Our Slack channel, which has 1,700 members and a lot of awesome information that gets shared there, is going to be sunsetting soon. Because we don't have paid seats for every single member, the history gets blown away fairly quickly, and that's one of the paywalls that Slack has, so there's not a lot we can do about it. I love the way Slack works, but I don't like that we lose all that collective knowledge we've been building together. So we've decided to make a move over to a new platform that can be found at community.limacharlie.io. The platform we are using is called Discourse. I'm sure a lot of you have encountered this elsewhere. It's more of a forum type experience, but much better suited to growing a valuable and searchable knowledge base over time. We're going to have both platforms running for the time being, but we'll be sunsetting the Slack channel at some point in the not too distant future. So if you want to continue to be a part of the intel sharing that all of these chats are based on and get that information in real time, you can go sign up at community.limacharlie.io. Again, that is community.limacharlie.io. And as always, I'm joined by the articulate globetrotter himself, the one and only Matt Bromley. How are you doing today, sir?
There he is, Chris. I'm doing well, sir. Doing well. Looking forward to another week abroad recording this here for you. I am currently coming to you live, if you will, recorded for the listeners, but to you live from Munich, Germany, and enjoying the wonderful rain that is going on outside right now. So it is an interesting weather pattern, but nonetheless, great to be here with you and always looking forward to sharing these international adventures with our listeners.
And what are you doing in Munich? Is it training? Are you there for a conference? What's the story?
Yeah, a little bit of, I've been on this European tour. It's been a little bit of conferences, a little bit of vacation, a lot of work and networking. And then there's a training event I'm at out here as well. So I'll be here through the end of this week. So for those listeners who might be watching the video side of things, you might see me in a familiar background next week. Who knows? Maybe, possibly.
Always exciting to see where Matt's popping in from.
We'll see. Actually, now I'm thinking about it, it might be different next week. Who knows? We'll see. I'll keep that secret for us.
All right. So this one is maybe not cybersecurity exactly, but it's such big news and it's around OPSEC that I think it warrants discussion. So on March 24th, The Atlantic's editor-in-chief Jeffrey Goldberg reported a significant OPSEC failure involving U.S. Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth, who allegedly sent him detailed U.S. military plans over Signal, an encrypted messaging app. On March 15th, the message reportedly included precise timing for airstrikes on Houthi targets in Yemen, which occurred approximately 2 hours later. Goldberg, who received the Signal message at 11:44 a.m. Eastern Time, claims that the conversation also involved naming an active U.S. intelligence officer and included discussions of sensitive military strategy. He eventually left the chat after realizing the nature of its contents. Multiple U.S. officials have confirmed the authenticity of the exchange during a Senate Intelligence Committee hearing. Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard and CIA Director John Ratcliffe acknowledged their presence in the chat, along with Vice President J.D. Vance and Secretary of State Marco Rubio. This is like a big roster of names. However, both Gabbard and Ratcliffe downplayed the seriousness of the leak, asserting that no classified material or intelligence equities were disclosed. If Goldberg's account is accurate, this would be one of the most prominent operational security breaches in recent memory, particularly because of the number and of senior officials involved and the apparent lack of protocol. So, Matt, the floor is yours, sir.
Yeah. Hats off to Trump for not being involved in this one. Yeah. Just start by saying, wow, the gaffe was in the VP office and then some. I've read through the article. I'm sure everyone who's listening has probably heard of this in some way, shape, or form. I will tell you, being in the EU, when this article drops, you get a lot of sneers and European ha-ha coming at you. But it's an interesting take because at a minimum, I think everyone's past the point of saying this is, you know, faked or this isn't real. During the article in The Atlantic, there's actually a kind of a discussion from the author, Jeffrey Goldberg, who even goes as far as to say, like, I thought this was fake for a while. I didn't think it was real, but then I started lining things up and then the attack occurred. And I just want to go out and say to everyone out there, I mean, if you've ever been subject to TSSCI information, if you've ever had to get a clearance, if you've ever had to deal with sensitive data in any way, shape, or form, especially as it relates to national security, the amount of just absolute complete screw ups here, it's tough to even try to conceptualize the issue here. I'm not saying there's any issue with Signal necessarily, Chris, although there is definitely a large forensic discussion to be had about whether Signal messages at rest are encrypted. Hint, hint, they're likely not. But it is the, you know, it is kind of the encryption and motion is what everyone sorts to lean on as, oh, this is safe and encrypted, right? Number one. Number two, highly doubtful it was an approved application, the messages that are going back and forth here. Three, Goldberg actually redacted some information that was disclosed, particularly a live CIA operative that was named during all of this. So to say, oh, nothing classified was leaked. Okay, well then, you know, clearly that's not the case. And hats off to Jeffrey Goldberg for not just disclosing everything that was in there. But more importantly, Chris, I think is also the representation here that this just kind of demonstrates. And we won't make this a political discussion. We'll keep it on the cybersecurity and the secure comm side of things. But just the complete lack of understanding of, you know, oh, this was safe to do. And just a complete dismissal of like, oh yeah, well, you know, we didn't trade anything too sensitive. We didn't talk about anything too sensitive inside of there. And it's just, I kind of feel like you caught your kid with, you know, their hand in the cookie jar. And the response they gave you was, there's still more cookies. Just because I took one, it doesn't mean they're all gone. And it's like, that's not what you were supposed to get out of this, number one. In fact, this never should have happened. So we'll keep, again, the political side out of it, but a massive lapse in, you know, potential national security. And I guess, Chris, as with most potential sensitive data breaches or incidents or compromises or whatever it is, now we know this happened, but I highly doubt this is the very first time a close-knit Signal group has been created to facilitate these types of discussions and back and forth. I just think the wrong person got added to it. For us, the right person, but the wrong person got added to it this time. Doesn't mean it didn't happen before, and it doesn't mean it won't continue to happen.
Yeah.
You know, I did read somewhere that under the Obama administration, Signal was approved for some people to have on their phones. I don't think it was the problem here. I think the really big problem here is that these call logs are not documented in a way that is required by officials operating at that level. So it's sort of the secrecy side. There's also how secure is Signal went up against nation states and stuff like that. I think that's an issue too, or accidentally adding people because you don't understand how the UI works very clearly, or encryption at rest, all these other things I think are concerns too. But it's really sort of like, why are they not using official channels where these kind of conversations are logged if that has to be looked at by Congress or somebody like that? I think that's sort of the part that I thought smelled the funniest.
It's the lack of an audit trail. It's that the audit trail belongs to a third party or a private company or something like that. And then, you know, I will be fair, Chris, and say, like, from a technology perspective, there is a little bit of kind of administrative pushback for this. Oddly enough, you brought up Obama. I remember when Obama was elected, there was actually a really big, you know, big fight because he wanted to keep his BlackBerry. And I think the White House protocol was you don't keep to your BlackBerry. And they actually found a way to make it work.
Or was it the iPhone? I think the BlackBerry was the approved one because that was their big thing, was encrypted email, I think. Or do I have that backwards?
Oh, no, he wanted to keep it.
Okay.
Yeah, he wanted to keep it. I believe that I think there was maybe a different model they wanted him to have. And I'm kind of looking at it now. It's an old article. We're talking 15 years, 16 years old now. But this was an older thing. Like, he was adamant he wanted to keep it. And the big deal here, and maybe the larger discussion point, was Obama came in kind of as a tech president, understanding technology maybe more than predecessors had, and was like, I'm keeping my BlackBerry. So it forced a change of, like, can we actually use this thing? I would argue up to a point that's probably a little bit of what we're seeing here. We're used, you know, this group may be used to having closed door conversations inside, you know, closed door inside of a Signal group thread, which doesn't really deter from what normal citizens do, but you're not normal citizens anymore. You know, your Senate confirmed secretaries, you're the vice president, you're elected officials, you have access to extremely sensitive information, you're planning attacks on foreign nationals.
You're big targets for threat actors. Huge.
Be smart. Just be smart and use the approved channels. And don't forget, apparently communicating over email was a big deal, but Signal's okay. So we're going to leave the politics out of it. I'm just going to say, damning story, and really disappointing to see, to be honest with you, because it's the kind of story where you, You don't wish for anyone to be stuck in this situation where you find out they're using this technology, number one. Number two, guess what that does for Signal? It now puts it on a more heightened or amplified radar for exploit development, testing, and things like that. And maybe we all lose the benefit because now it's a known medium, known communication.
All right. So security experts have been highly critical of the situation, especially the use of Signal for such communication. While Signal offers end-to-end encryption and is considered secure for consumer use, including by journalists and dissidents, it is not approved for discussing national security matters. Callie Schroeder of Epic noted that Signal is neither authorized for government devices nor compliant with protocols for handling federal records or classified discussions. The use of messages that go away, and unclassified platforms violates both record-keeping obligations and core cybersecurity standards, particularly if participants use personal devices on public networks. Criticism also focused on the apparent accidental inclusion of Goldberg in the chat, which reportedly originated from a contact misclick by National Security Advisor Michael Waltz. That oversight, adding a journalist to a conversation involving potential airstrikes, underscored what experts are calling a culture of carelessness. Schroeder described the breach as maybe the sloppiest information leak she has seen and warned the official's failure to recognize an unfamiliar number or question the platform's appropriateness points to a lack of basic security literacy. Additionally, technical experts like Frederick Jacobs and Matthew Green have raised concerns that Signal could now face undue scrutiny or expectations far beyond its intended scope as a consumer messaging platform. While Signal remains highly secure within its design parameters, the misuse places both the tool and national security at unnecessary risk. So yeah, I think it's pretty damning all the way around. I don't know if there's much more to say about it, but wow.
Don't do this stuff.
Yeah, man.
Don't do this stuff. Yeah. That's what I'm going to say. Don't do this business. Come on. Yeah. Like, you know, represent right.
Okay, let's move on. A newly discovered supply chain attack on the NPM ecosystem is targeting developers by backdooring local packages through a process known as manifest confusion. Security researchers at Phylum uncovered a malicious campaign where attackers uploaded packages with similar names to popular libraries, but with manipulated package.json files. This tricked build tools and IDEs into incorrectly resolving dependencies, essentially replacing legitimate local packages with malicious ones. The attacker specifically exploited differences in how local and remote packages are prioritized during the resolution process, making the malicious packages appear valid even though they injected obfuscated payloads. One key tactic involved inserting invisible Unicode characters, such as right-to-left override or zero-width spaces, into file names, which made the malicious files harder to spot in IDEs or Git diffs. Once executed, the payloads established a backdoor by exfiltrating system information to a remote server and setting up remote command execution capabilities. The campaign wasn't widespread, but rather seemed to be targeting individual developers or small teams, possibly as a proof of concept or as part of a more targeted supply chain compromise. The malicious packages often mimicked internal packaging naming conventions, increasing the likelihood that developers would trust and unknowingly install them. Wow, this one's a little bit terrifying. Overriding the package.json with similar file names, that seems pretty sneaky.
Yeah, this is one that I found a little interesting. So a hat tip to the folks over at Reversing Labs who went and put this one together here. Really great blog post, great walkthrough to see in there. But interestingly enough, they do mention in the post there, and Chris, I know you walked through some of the technical details, but they do mention like the NPM package repository is never quiet. But then they go and pick up on two particular malicious packages that they identified. Simple downloaders, malicious payload was hidden. And we're talking about second stages. It actually patches a legitimate package, which is installed locally, and then with a new file that includes the malicious payload. So it's almost kind of like seeking out the legitimate one and then replacing it with a legitimate file. Seeking out the legitimate one, replacing it with a malicious file. There we go. A little bit of a interesting concept here, primarily because it breaks a little bit outside of what we normally expect when we see kind of like supply chain compromises or supply chain issues, which is just straight up installing a malicious package, and then that malicious thing does the malicious stuff, if you will. Instead, this is one that seeks out a legitimate one, just replaces some files. So without some careful, crafty, like NPM checking, maybe some integrity validation or something like that, you're going to end up in a weird situation where you might look like you have a legitimate package installed, but it's got some malicious files. To be fair, and I'm looking right at the code right here, there's some multiple stages to it, but There's some obfuscated code drop in, looks and functions the same as the legitimate package, but then includes some additional malicious code that, once deobfuscated, actually downloads a third stage piece of malware from hard-coded C2, runs and executes it, all JavaScript-based, of course, but then now, wow, we're popped just by having a legitimate one on there. The other thing I'll add to this one, which I found a little bit interesting, was that if you were to remove the malicious NPM library that you or the package you had pulled down, that would not remove the malicious code. So the actual like dependency that was, or I should say the malicious file being created as a result of it, would not get unraveled in the process. And I think that's just another way for adversaries to like evade deletion. We talk about evading detection a lot. I think this is one to evade deletion where you could say, oh, that library is bad, get rid of it. Still good because your code is still there, still present, and still active. So an interesting form of persistence inside of an NPM. And another way, again, that we see adversaries just kind of continuing to take advantage of software supply chains, library dependencies, code dependencies, and things like that.
Yeah. And, you know, as somebody that works on keeping a bunch of our React projects compliant in dealing with updating all the NPM stuff when vulnerabilities come out, I can say that package.json file is very confusing and there's lots of overrides and things that happen in there. So it's a really clever place to insert a little bit of misdirection because it's going to be hard to catch from anybody just looking at it with their eyes, right? So
yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Definitely one like for a very technical acumen to like, hey, how do we go through detecting and avoiding this? Because again, it's not something that your developers are going to be actively looking at all the time. I would say one of the saving graces, Chris, might actually be when you go to do like a git pull or a git status, it's like, hey, this file's different. You're like, why is that one file different? Right? As opposed to everything else. That might be, and again, that's if you're syncing the full libraries. If you're just simply importing at runtime, you might not know the difference.
Yeah. So unlike typical typo squatting attacks that rely on uploading similarly named packages to trick developers pulling from the public registry, this campaign focuses on poisoning the developer's local environment. That makes it particularly dangerous because it can bypass standard security measures like lock files or integrity hashes, which usually protect against malicious updates from the registry. Developers use mono repos or linking local packages development are especially vulnerable since the poisoned packages can override local dependencies during automated builds or tests. The report underscores the need for better tooling around dependency resolution visibility and trust verification. IDEs and package managers could benefit from warning systems that detect suspicious package.json metadata, Unicode anomalies, or unexpected file structures. Developers are also being advised to audit local dependencies more rigorously, especially in shared repos, and avoid mixing local and remote packages with similar names. This attack vector adds another layer of complexity to the already challenging landscape of JavaScript supply chain security. That is an understatement, and it serves as a reminder that not all threats originate from the public registry. Some can infiltrate through internal development processes. So yeah, I think a lot of us have complained about NPM and the complexity of making a website or a simple web application, but it looks like it's going to be targeted for a while.
Yeah, I mean, we're not going to stop talking about software supply chain, code repository, and package poisoning. I mean, we've talked about it from a Python perspective, from an NPM perspective. We've seen it in Go. We see it across, you know, I mean, it's going to be out there for a while. It's going to be something we talk about, I think, Chris. And it's definitely also in the forefront of kind of newer emerging products and technologies that are coming out as well, being able to understand and scan code repositories, scan supporting libraries, find vulnerabilities, identify them. I mean, it's an ongoing thing. So for anyone out there who's got a strong developer base in their company, look and see if these tools are something you can add in, because it's going to be vital. It's going to be necessary to have. And we're about to talk about another incident that illustrates why this happens. It's not the only thing that involves workflows and pipelines as a potential attack vector.
Yeah. And to that point, Unit 42 researchers at Palo Alto Networks have uncovered an ongoing software supply chain attack targeting GitHub repositories via malicious GitHub action workflows. The campaign, which has been active since at least early 2023, involves threat actors injecting malicious code into open source repositories that misuse GitHub actions to execute crypto mining payloads. The attack is particularly notable because it doesn't rely on the typical route of publishing malicious packages. Instead, it abuses automated CI/CD pipeline logic through pull requests, targeting repositories with self-hosted or misconfigured workflows. The attackers submit pull requests containing modified workflow files or .yaml configurations that, once merged or triggered, launch cryptojacking scripts using GitHub-hosted runners or self-hosted infrastructure. In some cases, the attackers even exploit public forks, where GitHub actions are automatically triggered upon pull request submission. The attack's effectiveness hinges on how many repositories have default or permissive workflow settings, which allow such jobs to be executed with minimal user interactions. The campaign was broad, affecting over 100 repositories across multiple organizations and open source projects. This reminds me a lot of the research a guy named Adnan Khan has been doing, which I think, Matt, we met originally at B-Sides San Francisco, probably in 2023 or 2022 even. He's done a bunch more stuff in talking about how these automated actions can be poisoned and in the kind of damage they can do inside an organization. So fascinating stuff that I think is, you know, in that supply chain vector, just super active for threat actors.
It's so funny you bring this up, Chris. He's actually, first off, quoted in the Unit 42 blog post.
Oh, is he?
An excellent one. He's quoted and referred to in there. And you're 100% right. I guess we're coming up on 2 years ago at B-Sides San Francisco. Coming up on almost 2 years ago, we had the chance to meet Adnan. And he was like, hey, come check out my talk. We were a little busy at the time, but I watched the recording of it and got the slides. And it was exactly this. It was like, I'm going to show you guys some ways that GitHub, you know, is vulnerable. And when everyone thinks GitHub being vulnerable, they think like, what's this going to do to my Git repos? Or, you know, someone's going to find a command or, you know, supplement code or something like that. I don't know if he was talking specifically about this at the time, but this particular attack picks up on the GitHub Actions, the CI/CD, the continuous improvement and development or integration development. I forget the I part of that, but regardless, it takes advantage of those runners of automatically integrating workflow components, code repositories, and things like that. And there's actually quite a kind of daisy chain of how these compromises took place. You know, the one that was originally compromised or was detected was a changed files one. That was actually compromised because it utilized an ESLint, which relied on an action setup. I mean, it's like two or three layers of dependencies to go down before you get to the actual thing that happened. And then, of course, we had to roll up the mitigations as well, which at the time of this recording has all been done by now. But I will say, like, a lot of organizations had to quickly implement some fixes and mitigations because they were vulnerable to it. Tens of thousands of GitHub repositories were utilizing this. And it's just goes to show kind of at the size and scale, you know, GitHub Actions was debuted as like a way to help automate your CI/CD pipelines. It was a way to allow organizations to quickly find deficiencies in deployment and things like that, created another attack vector. So huge hats off to Adnan for kind of sticking with it and getting quoted here, number one. Number two, again, this goes back to what we talked about with our earlier article about kind of package poisoning, package.json poisoning. There's a lot of different entry vectors and a lot of different ways adversaries will find, you know, opportunities to take advantage of your code workflows. Do what we can to lock those down and secure them, but just know they're out there and we've got to keep that developer workforce just as vigilant as security, Chris, not by making them security experts, but by either implementing tools that help them keep track of things, one, or two, as a security team, getting that visibility up there so you can be that steward, that custodian of developer-friendly security. And I'm not, you know, here to advertise any solution, just here to say, if this is not already in your security posture and your threat modeling, you're missing out. Adversaries are using it.
Yeah. And, you know, to the point that you made there, I think if we look far enough in the future, developers and security folks, it starts to look like the same thing. I think everybody's got to gain this awareness, gain this knowledge. It's got to be a part of everything we're doing when we're building out this infrastructure.
I mean, the term is what? DevSecOps, SecDevOps.
Yeah, you're supposed to put the dev first, I'm told. Otherwise, it's insulting.
I'm told, but I'd like to put security first if I could. But yeah, it's not always up to me. But yeah, I mean, there's definitely historical integration examples here. Let's just make it successful because, you know, threat actors are finding it. And let me be clear about one other thing here. This isn't any organization like did something wrong. It was the developer's fault. It was, you know, an issue on the GitHub side of things. That doesn't, first off, say, oh, let's never use GitHub again. It's not, you can just sign off of a, you know, a code hosting platform or a revision platform. It's part of everyone's workflow. So making developers aware and allowing them to say, there's a compromise, this thing has happened, enable and empower them to quickly make the changes they need to make so that you can get back up, either back up and running, or you can say, this is no longer an issue for us.
Mm-hmm. So the payloads observed by Unit 42 were primarily focused on Monero mining using open source tools like XMRig and were obfuscated to evade detection within the workflows. In some instances, attackers cleverly disguised their malicious workflows to resemble legitimate CI jobs using common naming conventions and harmless-looking environmental variables. the threat actor's wallet and mining pool activity revealed earnings from multiple campaigns, indicating that this technique has been both persistent and profitable. Researchers also identified the same infrastructure being reused across different GitHub accounts, pointing to a coordinated effort. Unit 42 has notified GitHub and affected repository maintainers, and GitHub has taken action against many of the malicious accounts. However, this incident highlights a growing trend. Attackers are shifting their focus from direct package poisoning to exploiting weaknesses in development infrastructure. GitHub actions widely adopted for CI/CD can become an unintentional attack surface when workflows are not tightly scoped or reviewed. Developers are being urged to audit workflows, restrict permissions, disable automatic triggering for untrusted forks, and monitor unusual job activity. As attackers increasingly target automation systems in CI/CD environments, maintaining strict security hygiene and workflow configurations is becoming essential for software supply chain integrity. And, you know, just reading that, I can see part of the problem, because I know when you're setting this stuff up, looser permissions make things easier, default configurations make things easier, and now you got it working, and you're just trying to move on to the job that you're trying to accomplish. But I think we're past that golden era where we can just move fast and not worry about breaking things, because this is serious stuff.
Everything's got to be double checked, triple checked, and then we've got to document it and keep track of it all, and then know that we could be vulnerable at any time. But, you know, where's the fun in that? Just build fast, fail fast.
Well, I think we got to think about it really like engineering. You don't just freestyle building a bridge anymore, because we see what happens. There's a process and there's a way to do things properly that we know is not going to result in catastrophic failure or big security breaches in this case. So we really need to start to adopt those practices and mindset, which is hard when the race to the market is the thing that decides who wins and loses. So, yeah.
And also, the only thing I'll add to that before we kind of beat it too much to death, but the only thing I'll add is you're also talking about a workforce or a series of folks who are probably not used to wearing security hats. And that's another big ask as well. You know, even if there's a startup out there somewhere with two or three people who are working on building out the next big thing, they're working out of, you know, garages or conference rooms or coffee tables, whatever it is. And they might say, hey, I'm able to, you know, POV this thing, or I'm able to get to an MVP, you know, based on all these additional resources that are out there. They're not in the security mindset to know I need to do this thing, or, hey, here's a notification. Should I go and investigate that? It's not until they get further on down the line that they might say, hey, you've got this vulnerable code. They're trying to pass a compliance. They bring on a security minded person. And that might be too long of a runway. So it's got to be an earlier notification process and then an earlier involvement process as well.
Yeah. And I think we kind of live in a bit of a echo chamber or a bubble, because I recently asked for a couple intros through somebody into a few robotics companies I thought Lima Charlie would be a really good fit for. I won't say any names, obviously, you know, two Series A and one Series B company. And the responses back from all of the founders through my intro was, oh, we're not thinking about security yet. And when you think about the IP involved, and just, I was stunned. And I think that's a culture that's got to change. I know we have to get to market. We have to prove our value. We've got to, you know, win capitalism, but we got to do it in a way that's secure and make that part of the culture.
Agreed. Agreed. Cannot agree with you more.
Preaching to the choir. It's easy.
That's right. We talk about this every week.
Yeah. Awesome, man. Thanks for coming out again, and have fun in Germany. That's one of the places on my bucket list. I'd love to see it. There's some pretty fascinating architecture and things to see there.
There's some beautiful things.
So I hope you're getting a chance to walk around and look at stuff.
I have. Yeah, actually a huge thanks. If anyone here is located in Munich and listens to the podcast, thank you for sharing your wonderful city with me. It's been beautiful. But Chris, as always, great to be here with you, sir. I'll see you again soon.
Yeah, take care, sir.
See ya.
And that concludes this episode of the Cybersecurity Defenders podcast. If you have any feedback or ideas for future topics, please send an email to defenders@limacharlie.io. You can access the intel we talk about on the show in real time and join the conversation on the Lima Charlie Community Slack channel at slack.limacharlie.io. If you've enjoyed the show, please consider sharing it with someone or leaving a rating or review. And don't forget to subscribe on whatever platform you're listening from. Thanks for listening in. We'll see you on the next episode.